Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, now celebrating their 125th anniversary. From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Family. We all have one. But family can come from so much more than birthright. Chef Cal Peternell has two families. There's his wife and three sons in Berkeley, and there's his restaurant family at Alice Waters Chez Panisse. Just down the road from Chez Panisse, the Callahan family bought some sheep to keep their pasture grasses down. They put those sheep to work and now handcraft some of the finest cheeses made in America. And over on St. Charles Avenue in New Orleans, Polly Watts transformed her dad's dive bar into one of America's great craft beer palaces, all in the name of family. So sit back and enjoy a visit with some of my favorite families on this week's Louisiana Eats. In the farm-to-table category, there might not be a more emblematic kitchen than Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California. Since 1971, Alice Waters Restaurant has become internationally renowned by sourcing locally and seasonally, trends which are now the norm in most fine dining restaurants. Behind the stove there for the past 20 years is Cal Peternell, a man whose professional and domestic families have spent so much time together, it's hard to separate the two.
I was thinking about getting ready to kind of maybe have to leave the restaurant business because I had one son who was three and my second son was on the way. And I just started thinking, you know, I was looking around at my peers and none of them seemed to be married, let alone have kids, because, you know, it's you work nights and you work long hours and weekends, and so the restaurant business doesn't always lend itself to the family life. But then when I got to Chez Panisse, I knew right away I had made the right decision because they agreed to hire me about 3 weeks before my son was due to be born, my second son, Milo. You know, I said, well, are you sure you want – we can just wait because I'm going to need to have time off. And if you want to just wait, you know, in a month or something and hire me then. And they said, oh, no, don't worry about it. We'll give you the time away after your son's born to be with him. So – that's the kind of thing I think that earns people's loyalty and keeps them around a long time. It's such a unique place to work that when, you know, when people leave, we often say to them, half kiddingly, you know, you'll be back. And about half the time they do come back because they get out there in the big ugly world and they, you know, they just come home. You're probably familiar with the restaurant culture that there's a lot of turnover. There's kind of this annual turnover. In the restaurants I worked in before, it seemed like we spent so much time training people to do the job and not enough time actually cooking with them or cooking ourselves. And because you don't have that turnover at Chez Panisse, you really do get to dig in deep and really, really cook. And that is part of what makes the dining experience what it is and also keeps people around. Plus, we change the menu every day, so it keeps it interesting.
It's really a remarkable place, and it's such a intimate, tiny little space, yeah, too, in so many ways. Who decides what's going to get cooked? How does that process work?
Well, the chefs do. So I do for the downstairs restaurant, and then there's two chefs in the downstairs restaurant as well, myself and Jerome Bog. We share the job now. We do half the year on and half the year off, which also helps keep us around because we get a 6-month sabbatical basically every year. So we write the menus, and Alice's role is as a critic for the downstairs menus, since we publish them a week ahead. You know, we do the whole week's worth of menus. We submit them to her in writing, and she goes over them. And then when she's in town, she travels quite a bit, but when she's in town, she's there all the time, and she sticks a fork in whatever dish is coming up and tells us what she thinks, which is can sometimes be difficult, but is a wonderful opportunity to have someone who is so sharp about food and is so thoughtful to give you their honest opinion. Because as she always points out, you can feed something to the – or you put a dish out in front of somebody and they take a taste and they say, oh, it's delicious. Even if maybe they think there might be something that could be better, but sort of politeness. And not that Alice is impolite, but she wants it to be this certain way. She wants it to be the best it can be. And so she's free with her opinions, which is mostly something that I really appreciate.
I would like you to introduce us to your family. Tell us about the boys and
your wife. My wife, Kathleen Henderson, is we met at college at art school, and I sort of at some point veered off into the cooking world, but she's still making art. And then we have three sons. My oldest son is Henderson, who's about to graduate from the Cooper Union School in New York. He's 22, and then Milo is 19 and is at Bennington in Vermont, also an art school. And we have a little guy, Liam, who's 10, and he's in fifth grade. In fact, Liam, his school is right between our house and Chez Panisse, so it's about a three-minute walk from the restaurant. And when I'm there and my wife is working, I walk over and pick him up, and we walk back, and Liam loves to eat soup. The cafe always has some soup, so I'll heat him up a nice big bowl of soup, and nothing nicer than to feed your kid a big bowl of soup after school. And he sits in the dining room while the waiters are setting up and kind of works on his homework and eats his soup, and then maybe I'll get him a little cookie or an ice cream or something. So that still goes on. And the other boys, you know, similar kinds of things. They were there a lot. And the older boys both worked there. Stints in the kitchen, just sort of volunteering here and there, so because they wanted to come in and learn some things, and they both also worked as bussers in the cafe.
Do all three of them, or have you seen this light bulb moment in any of them when they're like, "Wow, we grew up at Chez Panisse"?
I think it's very familiar, but they also know that when they tell people that, people are just kind of like, wow, that's the greatest thing I ever heard of. You know, my son Milo told me that he sometimes holds back that information because I do it too. People ask me, you know, especially in the Bay Area, you know, people say, oh, what do you do? I'm a chef. Oh, where are you, chef? Oh, this restaurant in Berkeley. And I try and kind of leave it there if I can. And then if they say which one and I say Chez Panisse and they're like, oh, just some restaurant in Berkeley, huh? No, but it's great to have the kids there. And you know, I'm not the only chef or person working there who has kids. So we get to see each other's kids all the time. So, that's a wonderful thing.
Oh, my goodness. Those lucky boys.
Yeah.
Cal, I'm really curious, you know, my goodness, why is your inclination to sometimes be sort of undercover out in the greater world as the Chez Panisse chef?
Well, I think primarily because it can be kind of like a showstopper in a way, and it can be a little bit awkward, and maybe I'm not comfortable with that. But also, you know, because we have a sort of ethical stance about food as well, we're sort of a target for people. I think every restaurant that's at a certain level of like cooking – I was going to say fine dining, but I kind of hate that term – but of, you know, a higher level of cooking, people are – taking pot shots at you and trying to take you down, but especially because, you know, we do have this sort of ethical thing about eating, that it's right to eat in the season and to try and eat locally and try and eat organically and sustainable agriculture and all that. So, you know, it kind of can open that up a little bit. I did a reading in a bookstore a week or so ago, and at the end of the reading, there was some time for question and answers. And often the questions that people ask aren't actually questions. They're just something that they want to say about how they cook or something, which is fine. But one person actually took a shot at Chez Panisse and just said, well, you know, I ate there. I didn't think it was that great. Sometimes people want to take it down a notch, like, oh, well, you think you're so good. The Yelpers I'm talking about, I guess.
One last question. What are you hoping for the boys?
Well, I think that my oldest son, he's going to graduate in December. He wants to travel, but he needs to kind of save up some money for a while, and I'm hoping he's going to work with us at the restaurant for a while. In summers, he's had a job in a restaurant up in Gloucester, so he's a good cook. He's a very good cook. He actually made me a delicious meal last Saturday. And, you know, for the other two, I just want them to do what makes them happy. And I think they are doing that. So we're on the right track.
Well, there is no way they couldn't be on the right track with you for a dad,
no.
Cal. So thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me. And it's been great so far, although it's cold here.
Oh, hush up. Let's go hit the streets.
All right.
Cal Peternell, chef at Alice Waters Chez Panisse. His first cookbook is 12 Recipes, available in bookstores everywhere.
Oh, you are my family tree. Be good to me. Take care of me.
I laughed out loud when I opened Cal Peternell's 12 Recipes and discovered the title of the first chapter was Toast. Toast? From the 20-year chef of the award-winning Chez Panisse restaurant, we begin with toast? But once I read his wise words, I understood his point of view and climbed right on the toast bandwagon. Just think of how many kinds of toast there really are. Thin, crisp toast, thick, soft toast, and those toasty relations, croutons, and breadcrumbs. Here's Cal's advice. First, get out your timer. Whether you're toasting bread or toasting nuts, they're both too easy to forget in the precious seconds that are all it takes to fill your kitchen with that acrid burn smell. Use that timer and use good bread. Buy the best bread you can because you'll use every crumb, literally. Make thin, crisp toast from stale bread, sprinkled with olive oil and a touch of salt, then baked in a 350-degree oven until browned and shatteringly crisp. Thick, soft toast starts with fresh bread. Rub the bread with a raw garlic clove and drizzle with oil, or butter them and top with sugar and cinnamon before baking at 400 degrees. Once they're done, let them cool for a few minutes and then dig right in. Thick toast is for eating right away. Crumble any leftover thin toast for croutons, or crush them with your rolling pin to make breadcrumbs. Or for big, crisp croutons, slice the bread into cubes and drizzle them with oil, then bake until crispy. Much ado about nothing? Take my word for it. Cal Peternell's toast is far from nothing. I'm Poppy Tooker. And you're listening to Louisiana Eats. What is rennet, and what do you do with it? Stay tuned to learn all about rennet when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What is rennet, and what do you do with it? There are two kinds of rennet, animal and vegetable. Animal rennet is an enzyme that can be obtained from the stomachs of young calves, lamb, or goats, which has been used to coagulate cheese for thousands of years. If that turns you off, you'll be happy to hear that vegetable rennet works just as well. It's made from thistle, so there's nothing scary about that. Just put several drops in milk, and a few hours later, you'll have a beautiful soft cheese curd floating in whey. You can find small eyedropper-sized bottles of vegetable rennet in the cheese section of health food stores. Rennet is your ticket when you're ready to start experimenting with cheese making, and a crucial ingredient if you ever want to try making your own Creole cream cheese. So get your own bottle and let the experimentation begin. I'm Poppy Tooker, and this is Louisiana Eats.
On the way to California, and I don't mean California, literally.
As Cal Peternell told us, one of the reasons Chez Panisse has been so successful is because of their access to Northern California's bountiful agriculture, which includes everything from produce to meats to cheeses. If you ever find yourself on the West Coast and decide to meander through the rolling hills of Sonoma County, you should consider looking for Bellwether Farms, California's first sheep's dairy and a cheese producer for restaurants like Chez Panisse. Get there early enough and you'll find Liam Callahan busily milking the 250 ewes that graze his family farm's hills and pastures.
Dairy animals want this to happen. If they don't want to, they don't give you milk. One of the funny things is the ones that are most engaged with the process, the ones that give you the most milk, are always the ones that come in first. And the ones that are at the end of the string are the ones that are like, I'm kind of really not that into this. You know, I could do without. And they also give you the least amount of milk.
It was about 10 in the morning when we met Liam in the milking parlor, but he was already finished cleaning up from the morning session.
Sheep milk out very quickly, so it really takes as much time to prepare them and clean them and everything as it does just to milk them. The cows milk a lot longer. To give you an idea, the smallest cows, like a Jersey, may give you 5 gallons of milk a day. The super high production cows, the Holsteins, the black and white ones, they can give you 12 gallons of milk a day. A sheep, we're happy if we can average 0.5 gallon of milk a day.
Not one to be frivolous with time, Liam quickly led us into the cheese room where he was making two types of cheeses.
It gets a little steamy in here. We've added exhaust fans and sorts of that sort of stuff over the years, so it's not as bad. It used to be an immediate, like a sweat hut. You know, you got in here and you just sweated through your clothing, and that was how it was. So it's a little bit more comfortable now than it once was, but it's still pretty foresty, you know, tropical for sure.
Now to clarify, Bellwether Farms is a sheep's dairy, but they also make cow's cheese there.
Our cow's milk is all Jersey milk. We buy from a neighbor down the street who milks all the little brown cows. They're higher, and the milk is higher and fat than other breeds of cow, which gives you a little bit more of a flavor element that you get from that we like.
Liam had 9 plastic buckets lined up, each filled with 9 gallons of pasteurized cow's milk. With a few steps, these vats of milk would become Crescenza, a soft, ripened cheese that Liam learned to make in northern Italy.
The same basic steps are still being used by cheesemakers. We initiate a fermentation in the milk, and then we figure out a way to drain off the excess water. Now, by changing the rate of fermentation, the timing of it, and by changing the rate of moisture loss, you affect the chemistry that's going on, which is how you start every single cheese, from using the same ingredients.
To start the fermentation, Liam adds a particular batch of cultures to the milk. These bind the proteins together, thereby changing the milk's texture.
And you can make your own cultures, but it's a pretty tricky thing, and you can get off track really easily. And there's enough areas to get off track that I just like to start with a fresh batch every time. So this is made in France. It's a strain that I know works very well for this cheese. And then this culture only waits about 20 minutes before I'm going to add the coagulant, which is what changes the protein. Let me get the mix and thermometer. I'll be right back.
While the procedure might be the same for virtually every cheese, variables like time, temperature, and technique all come into play.
You give the bacteria 20 minutes or so to get started. Different recipes call for different periods of time because, again, the two things we're controlling is the rate of fermentation and the rate of drainage. So it gets kind of into the chemistry side of it, which is kind of a neat side of it, but it's a hard side if you're not actually at a vat regularly and see how some of these things affect the outcome.
Once the milk is fermented, enzymes like rennet are added to help the cheese coagulate. This separates the solids from the liquids the curds from the whey. And you can either use a natural or synthetic rennet.
We use the vegetarian on our cow milk cheeses. It's another thing that you see the benefits of it, the using natural rennet, if you're going to age the cheese longer. We did some taste tests, and if you're not going to go much over 60 days, you don't really start to see more complex flavors that you get from the natural rennet. So you might as well use one of the vegetable substitutes. They're less expensive as well. I visited cheesemaker in Sardinia where they actually had a bucket of salt that they kept on the floor. But they had a bucket of salt and this dried up, looked like a piece of roadkill really, but it was lamb stomach. And they would just cut a piece off, mash it up in some water, look kind of like anchovy paste, and throw it right in the milk.
So they just took the stomach and kept it in salt.
That's it. They dry it so that it doesn't rot, and the enzymes are in that stomach.
The crescenza lumps together as a block and must be mixed by hand very gently so the curd doesn't fracture. But not every cheese has to be handled this delicately. Liam was also in the process of making a creamy cheese inspired by an Italian pecorino. When they began making this style of cheese at Bellwether Farms, they named it Carmody, after a road that borders the farm.
At this point, it's ready, we can cut it, and that starts letting the whey drain out.
Liam had a 400-gallon stainless steel vat of cow's milk ready for the next step.
So the first cut we do will be a horizontal one, and then I'll come through and do the vertical one.
As Liam got to work, I thought about how physically demanding a cheesemaker's day is. Every day, they begin by corralling the animals, laying hands on each one as they're milked. Then there's buckets of milk to carry around, and the upper body workout from stirring enormous batches of cheese before shaping it into wheels.
It gets pretty heavy when it's this full. The sheet milk is a lot heavier because it has about 50% more solids. Yeah, I know how many passes I need to make to get the right drainage. And it changes with every vat, too. So when you go to a new vat, you have to try it a few different ways.
Cheese making is definitely a scientific process, but a lot of craftsmanship is also involved.
This 400 gallons is probably going to give us about 115 wheels. Then they go onto our turning tables where they'll stay for the next couple hours. Flip, 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 in order to get the rind consistent and formed. Then it'll go into our first aging room, a low-temperature room. It's going to stay there the next couple of days. That slows the drainage. We're able to salt it there. We come out of that with an actual cheese ready to go on a board and be aged out the rest of the way.
The Carmody wheels sit in a dry, cool room for 60 days, where they'll each lose about a pound of moisture. By the time they're ready for market, these cheeses, like all cheeses, will develop a flavor uniquely tied to the dairy where they're made.
You know, it's funny, in Italy and many parts of Europe, they have amazing traditions, and in many ways they're really trapped by them. You know, those guys that are making sheet milk cheeses over there, they have a relatively limited period of time, but and they wouldn't even think to say, well, maybe we could find someone with some cows and we could bring in and make cheese off our peak season to keep our equipment running or, you know, whatever. But they look at it as just another season that they're not making cheese. And I said, well, I'm trying to, impart a little California wisdom into this. I said, California, we really enjoy the traditional recipes, but we also enjoy seeing how they work with our ingredients so that the tradition is the technique, not necessarily the ingredient. And then we have other cultures there. So we see how that technique might work on ingredients from other cultures. He says, no, the recipes were perfect. They did not need to be changed. It was all right, you can do what you want.
Cheeses made by Liam Callahan at Bellwether Farms are available at the finest cheese shops across America. When it comes to dairy products, eaters tend to have extreme reactions. If you're lactose intolerant or vegan, its widespread use in dishes can be troublesome. And then there's those whose devotion to butter and cheese is insatiable. I'm one of those people. So is food writer Scott Gold.
Recently, I paid a visit to a cafe that brands itself as Fast French. The menu was on the large side for such a small place, filled mostly with salads and pastries and the like. Then, hovering near the bottom, I spied the following words: hot croque sandwiches. I knew immediately that I was in the right place. Croque sandwich, as you may or may not know, is just fancy talk for grilled cheese. And though a grilled cheese sandwich may seem a trifling thing, especially to a food writer who is often made acquainted with fancier menu items like a living terrarium of foie gras, it's also on my short list of things that make life worth living. If the food world were Hollywood and melted cheese on buttery toasted bread were an actor, it would be Meryl Streep, a living legend. My lifelong adoration of grilled cheese sandwiches began, unsurprisingly, in childhood, as a special weekend treat. On Sunday afternoons, as a reward for having survived another round of religious school without causing any incidents, my brothers and I would go crazy with anticipation as my mother would patiently press the bread flat in a sizzling cast iron skillet with plenty of butter until the American cheese, and it had to be Kraft American Singles, the sine qua non of grilled cheese cheeses, attained that perfectly gooey texture which is, in my experience, unique in all of nature. I went vegetarian once, for a week. Not for any health or ethical issues, mind you, but because I lost a bet to one of my vegetarian friends, and cutting meat out of my diet was her price. When the week was out, after I'd lived on meat analogs like seitan and textured vegetable protein processed to resemble chicken nuggets, I had this to say: not bad. I missed turkey sandwiches the most, I think, and bacon, of course, but I wasn't experiencing any delirium tremens or space madness for not having animal flesh in my diet. Had my friend Nicole stipulated in our wager that I would have had to go full-on vegan for 7 days, however, I'm fairly certain the week would have ended with me in full Jack Torrance mode, grunting like a madman eager to slaughter my entire family with an axe. I need dairy in my life. It is a necessity. I've literally awoken from nightmares in which a doctor notifies me that I'm lactose intolerant, a fate that would make me seriously consider the pros and cons of physician-assisted suicide. Give me dairy, or give me death. Which brings me back to Fast French. I had a little love affair with my hot croque sandwich filled with thick Irish-style rashers of bacon, Havartian thyme, grilled and topped with blowtorch-melted Gruyere. I enjoyed it so much I went back a few days later, but it wasn't the melted cheese that caught my eye this time. Oh no, it was the $4 combination of a freshly baked baguette, a real crusty French loaf, mind you, not pillowy New Orleans French bread, filled with smoky jambon and what the menu stated as good French butter. I expected a simple ham sandwich slathered with a little butter. What I got, however, was a football-sized loaf stuffed with meat and, the best part, three hefty wedges of that cold, creamy butter. With butter of this quality, you really can eat that much of it and feel perfectly fine, if not a little guilty. I mean, the French do it on a daily basis, and they're not keeling over by the truckload like we are here in the States. A friend of mine, a chef, recently moved to Paris with his wife and, in the process, managed to lose 25 pounds. His weight loss diet? Butter, cheese, bread, charcuterie, and wine. When he told me this, I nearly keeled over myself. So I think it's safe to say that I'll be headed back to that cafe for another baguette with jambon and good French butter, probably sooner rather than later. After all, as the t-shirt says, you have a friend in cheeses.
That was food writer and native New Orleanian Scott Gold. His Food Porn Fridays column can be found each week at nolavie.com. La pluie du ciel, oh 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 oh. When we come back from the next short break, Polly Watts tells the story of her family's bar, the Avenue Pub. Don't go anywhere. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Market. From out
Outside, the Avenue Pub looks a bit like the dive bar it once was. Today's owner, Polly Watts, has transformed her dad's old bar into one of the greatest craft beer locations in the South, and really, in fact, holds its own in that category nationwide. Polly, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you. It's exciting to talk about beer with somebody.
Well, it's an honor for me. So I'd like you to take us back to 2006. How long had your dad operated the Avenue Pub?
Oh, you're going to require higher math here. About 19 or 20 years at that point. So we're 27 years old this year. And I helped him open it when I was a senior at Tulane. But I stepped out of the business and helped him peripherally with some of his, you know, licensing stuff that I could do out of town. For all those years, I had a career with Bell South, and then I stayed home with my kids after they were born. So I did the stay-at-home mom thing. The year before Katrina, he started getting very ill. I was down here a lot helping him then. And then he passed away almost a year to the date after Katrina. So that's when I had to move down and fully take over. I thought I knew what I needed to know, but I learned a lot in a very short time.
It's so interesting to me that you went from this corporate atmosphere to owning a 24-hour-a-day bar. Was that, how did that huge life transformation feel for you? How did that go?
Well, it was bizarre. And I got to tell you, if we weren't the bar we were today, I would not still own it. Because walking in the morning and hearing that your toilet had broken because, you know, there was a prostitute in there. or you know, oh gosh, we went through, you know, 7 bottles of Jägermeister last night and somebody threw up on the floor. Those are the kinds of things I was dealing with. And, you know, I'm not squeamish. I own a bar, right? But that's not an intellectual challenge. That's not what I want to be doing with my life. So had I not made that transition into something else and done it and been successful at it and been able to pay myself, pay my employees, we have health insurance here for our employees, it's very unusual in the industry. If I had not been able to achieve all those things, I don't think I'd still own it because I wasn't interested in running that kind of bar.
Well, tell us how you began to experiment with craft beer. Was there a particular event that brought about this motivation?
Yes. So NOLA Brewing came into existence in March of 2009. I'm losing track of time now. 2009. And we had redone our system about 6 months before that. So we had at that time the most up-to-date, best system, cleanest lines in the city. NOLA came in and I thought, it was going to be an expensive local beer. I mean, we were used to Abita, and we could sell Abita for $2.50 or $3 a pint at the time. And the distributor's rep was telling me that NOLA was going to sell for $5 a pint. And I just didn't think there was any way that anybody was going to pay $5 for a pint of beer. So we saved lines for them. And it turns out to be this long sort of legendary thing because first they were going to come out in December. And the troubles that they went through with the city were huge. It took them 4 months actually to get their doors open and brew the first batch. And we saved 2 lines for them the whole time. We weren't a beer bar then. It was no big deal. And Kirk Coco, who I had never met, came in during Mardi Gras and started giving one of the bartenders a little bit of a tough time about why we didn't have NOLA. Well, my whole staff knew we were waiting on it. So Vicky turns around, not knowing who Kirk is, and says, well, if they would ever send it to us, it would be on tap. So Kirk sort of, you know, goes out with his tail between his legs because he knows he can't. They're not delivering beer yet. But the day that it released, they called me and said, you've held lines. They want you to be the first bar to have it on tap. How much do you want? I said, I'll take 1 keg of the brown and 1 keg of the blonde. And it was gone in less than 2 hours. I'd never seen anything like that. I mean, it was completely, so I figured it's a fluke, right? Once more people get it on tap, that's not going to happen. So we order 2 more kegs for the next day. Same thing happens. Literally, this happens for 4 or 5 days. Finally, Kirk comes in with his wife and the rest of his crew, and I get to know them. And he says, who are you, and why does my beer taste better here than it tastes at my brewery? And I kind of tell him the story. And he said, if you build it, they're going to come. I knew nothing about craft beer at the time. I just knew there was a great business opportunity that wasn't being met. So between Kirk and Dylan over at Nolan, Dan Stein over at Stein's Deli, they started introducing me to different beer styles. And I found that I actually really loved beer. I just didn't like crappy beer.
So in 2011, you went to one of the great sources, Belgium.
Yes.
And how did your view and taste for beer change after that trip?
Well, I've always loved Belgian beer. I mean, since I started discovering beer, I had a strong leaning towards Belgian beer. And I think my taste mirrors a lot of New Orleanians. We grew up with wine. And that flavor profile is so much more similar to wine. Belgian beer is so much more similar to wine. So I think that's part of why we evolved and did as well as we did, because New Orleans palates were already attuned to that taste profile. The trip to Belgium was awesome because I got to meet the people behind the beer. And, you know, you think of a beer that comes all the way in from the other country as having to be kind of a big brewery. And these places are just tiny. I mean, some of them are half the size of my building. And they send very little out of the country, or they just don't make that much. Belgium has a very, very long brewing tradition. So you get to meet a mixture of people where the brewing craft has been passed on from generation to generation, these family breweries. And there's a depth of experience and love for the craft there that we won't have for another 100 years in the United States because it's just so new to us.
Do you view yourself as a beer educator?
Yeah, I think that's part of what we do well here. A lot of the beers that we carry, nobody has ever heard of, or very few people have ever heard of them. And we believe strongly you should drink what you like. If you like a certain beer, we're not going to tell you you shouldn't drink it or that it's bad or anything like that. But if you like this Belgian wit, why not try this Belgian wit that has chicory root in it? Because that gives it, you know, a little bit of a touch. Or if you like this IPA that's made with Chinook hops, then, you know, see what you think about the Centennial hops or the Citra hops or the Simcoe hops. And I think that's part of the fun, because craft beer, it's not about getting drunk. The educational experience is what appeals to most customers that come in here. Certainly what we do here is very exciting, but I think our success is indicative of where craft beer is going in the city. And I think that to me is the most interesting thing to talk about. I'll just tell a story. I was with a friend, a former employee, who is looking at buying a bar elsewhere in the city, right? And I'm not going to tell you who or where, but let's just suffice it to say it's not in one of the uppity areas, right? And we go into this little, you know, it's a grungy little small dive bar. He asked me to just look around. So I was looking around and thinking about, you know, the obvious questions that he should ask, right, before he sinks his life savings into something. And I look at the taps and I said, what have you got on tap there? And they say, oh, we've got Terrapin Hopsecutioner and Nola Blonde. Now, this is a dive bar and they only have two taps, right? And 5 years ago, that would have been Bud and Coors. And I said, really? And how much do you go through? He says, we go through about half a keg every other day, a couple kegs a week. That is incredibly impressive. Now, he still sells Miller High Life and Coors and all that stuff in bottles. But the two tap lines that he has are both devoted to craft, and one of them's local. And it's selling, which I think is as exciting as it gets.
Polly, thank you so much for welcoming us into the Avenue Pub. And you'll see me at the bar here again soon, I promise. Thank you.
Good. Thank you, Poppy.
Craft beer maven, Polly Watts of New Orleans Avenue Pub. Polly Watts is just the second generation to mind the bar at the Avenue Pub. The tradition of sausage making in the Vaucresson family stretches back through four generations to the Alsace-Lorraine region of France. Today, Vance Vaucresson is the keeper of the flame at Vaucresson Sausage, a New Orleans tradition that dates back for almost a century.
As many people know, when you have a family-owned business, a lot of times the children are faced with a decision that they have to make. And I think we all pretty much, me and my brothers, we all started around 8 to 10 years old. And the challenge for us was to decide when we got older if we were going to continue and then eventually take on the business. Well, when it was time for me to finish school, I went to a small liberal arts college in Atlanta called Morehouse College. I'll never forget, my dad came up my senior year and pulled me to the side and said, son, you know, I've got this business and I really need some help. I know you're graduating, and I had a job with Kraft General Foods at the time. And he says, well, you know, I really wish you'd come back and work in the family business. And so I told him, I said, well, you know, Dad, I'm going to really give it some thought. And I never forget, they had a guy that had graduated from Morehouse. He was like probably the most decorated business graduate at the time, and he went off into corporate America, and we were just waiting to see him on the cover of Fortune one day and everything. He came back to speak with us, and he said, you know, I realized early on in corporate America that eventually I was going to hit a ceiling, but I really started to look at entrepreneurship as a way to continue to grow. And he says, I wish that I had a business of my own, that maybe I had a family that I could go into, or rather than start one from scratch, because it's something that in terms of the black community, having a generational business that keeps going and going, it's rare. And from hearing that from someone that I respected a great deal, I decided to really give it some thought. And I made the decision to go back, to come back home and really give it a try. Now, of course, working with my dad was, let's say, being baptized by fire, because if we didn't argue or fuss every day, I thought something was wrong. But it was a part of that whole concept of training me. He was toughening my skin. He was getting me ready. And for a lot of people who are considering going into a family business, it's not going to be easy. But trust me, that's how you grow and will be able to move forward into the next generation.
Let's talk about your dad, Sonny. His ambitions reached far beyond sausage making, didn't it?
My dad really walked on a different beat of a drum. I mean, he went to Xavier University. He didn't finish because my grandfather passed. And so my dad had to stop and get out of school and take over the business. But he just didn't want to do the whole butchering and the meat market. He had some brother-in-laws who... One had a liquor store, and another one helped manage the meat market. And my dad went ahead and got into the liquor store business. He started getting into real estate. And then also one of his most notable investments, he had a friend by the name of Larry Borenstein, who had a lot of property in the French Quarter. And they made the decision to open up a Creole restaurant on Bourbon Street. And it was the first business on Bourbon Street that had ownership with a person of color since Reconstruction.
How did that come about?
Well, you know, my dad did not have, he was very fair skinned. He had sky blue eyes, and he just did not look like a person of color. Even though he never denounced that he was a man of color, he just didn't look it. So a lot of people, when they got to know Sonny, they got to know Sonny. Not so much Sonny with a label of being a black man or a Creole or whatever. So a lot of the major players in the quarter, the Carno family, the Caracy family, they all got to know my dad and did business with my dad, and they liked him. So when the idea came up with Larry Borenstein to open this restaurant, all the powers that be blessed that particular union. They said, oh, if that's Sonny, it's okay. So they went along and they started process of opening the restaurant. But, you know, back then, that's the mid-60s. So you still had a lot of issues. And there was a meeting of the Bourbon Street Merchants Association. I believe that organization still exists today. And one of the topics, hush topics of the meeting was, they heard that they were going to have a, I'm not going to use the negative term, but one of those N-word people coming on to Bourbon Street, and how it was going to bring the property value down, and all those people were going to be coming into these establishments. And one guy that my dad knew sat down with he and Larry and said, you know, I'm just so upset this guy is coming on to Bourbon Street, and it's going to start something that's just going to bring Bourbon Street down, and I can't believe this. And he's looking around the room looking for the guy. Well, Larry Borenstein says, look, I know the guy. I'm going to introduce you to him. And he says, oh, please, I need to know who he is so I can keep my eye on him. And Larry says, yeah, you know Sonny Vokerson, right? He says, yeah, you know I know Sonny. I just shook his hand and gave him a hug. He says, well, that's the new N-word on Bourbon Street. My dad said the guy turned pale white, started to sweat, got up from the table, didn't say another word, and left.
That's a great story. So if you don't mind, would you tell us about when you lost your dad?
I'll never forget, I was doing the Alligator Festival in Bootsy. It was a Sunday, and my dad and I had recently made some great strides in our business. We had just won a large, very large account with the Orleans Parish School Board, and we were going to go ahead and distribute it ourselves. And we had done all this planning to deliver to 115 schools in one day. We had trucks we had rented and tens of thousands of pounds of product in our freezers and coolers, just busting at the seams. And we were so proud of ourselves. And our first delivery was going to be that Monday morning. Well, I was at the festival on that Sunday, and he had just been out there that Saturday. And he didn't seem himself, and he was walking around, and he was eating that fried alligator on a stick. I don't know. I looked at him that night, and he just wasn't himself. But, you know, you don't really think anything in particular. So the next day, that Sunday, was All Saints Day. And he went, and as a good Creole Catholic, went and visited all of the relatives at the cemetery. And they went, and he just didn't look right at the time. He started to get a little peaked and flushed in the face. And eventually, my aunt forced him to go to the hospital. So they were on their way to Ochsner Hospital at the time. Well, he had his heart attack right outside of Ochsner. They had about seven orderlies and different people to pick him up and get him to the emergency room because he was quite a large man. And I never forget, they called me. I was out at the festival. They called me and they told me he had a heart attack. I had a friend of mine pick me up and I went to the hospital. I didn't get a chance to see him. He died on the table, but there was a moment in there where when they came in and they told me, that's when I knew. Well, I actually had this feeling when I found out at the festival. I found out on a payphone. And when I was walking back to the booth, I knew right then and there. I said, okay, it's yours now. I don't think he's going to recover from this. I just knew right then and there. I said, okay, you got to have to step up. And so that night, I spent the night with my mom at the home. It was just she and I, and we were laying in the bed together, just looking at the ceiling, talking and trying to figure out what we were going to do. And she says, well, what are you going to do? I says, well, knowing my dad, I got to get up at 5 and go start loading these trucks. We worked so hard on this contract. I said, I can't let this stop. So it wasn't any morning time for me. I walked in there, all the people that were waiting for me. I said, well, you know, Sonny's not coming. He passed yesterday. I says, but knowing him, we got to keep this going. So I opened up the door to the factory. I broke down and cried for about 5 minutes, wiped my tears, and we started loading the trucks, and the rest is history.
That's the story of a family business.
Mm-hmm.
Vance Vokerson, the fourth generation of Vokerson sausage. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, just in time for Hanukkah, Creole caterer Bertha Pichon reveals secrets of the kosher kitchen.
So if I would have meatballs, I would have to leave them on a low fire all night because you can't turn the fires on Saturdays. Whatever flame you put it on Friday evening, have to sit like that till after sundown Saturday night.
Now that's going to require some special cooking tricks.
Well, I found that out, and guess what?
What?
I didn't fix them on meatballs.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakaman Ladies Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh and sound engineer Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next week. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.